Hello and welcome to Brokenomics, my lovely Brokenomicons. And in this episode, I thought, well, since last week I did that fancy newfangled Bitcoin stuff, didn't I? And I'm sure you will like that, but some of you might not have done. So I thought, well, this week, let's do good old-fashioned 80s style stocks and shares investing. And I was actually a fund manager for about 10 years or so, and I never figured out why we call it stocks and shares as opposed to just shares or stocks. And there must be a reason for that. I don't know what it is, but maybe Peter knows. So anyway, so I'm going to do it based on this book, Peter Lynch's One Up on Wall Street. So he was a fantastically successful fund manager. He ran the Magellan Fund, the Fidelity's Investments Magellan Fund, and he ran it for about 13 years, from 1977 to 1999. And in that time, the assets under management grew from 18 million to 14 billion, and he achieved a rate of return of about 30% a year. 29.2% on average was his annual return. So he ended up with the best performing mutual fund in the world, and of course it popularized his whole philosophy and his way of doing things, which we're going to be talking about today. He popularized the term 10 bagger. Stocks that appreciate tenfold from their initial investment. And he emphasized investing in companies that you understand with strong fundamentals that he believed were undervalued by the market. So, yes, very successful. Much of that appreciation of funds under management, that came from people seeing the success he was generating, putting money in. Because, of course, if you compound 18 million for 13 years, it's about half a billion, something like that. It's still an extraordinary level of success, but people flocked to him after he retired, and he retired at a fairly young age. I think he retired in his mid-40s or something, and then he wrote a book on how it is done. So it is genuinely one of the best books in investing. Actually, true story, when I first started in the fund management business, on the first day, the boss handed me this. We had a different cover at the time, but he handed me this book, another book called Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, which is an even older book than this one. That one goes back to the turn of the previous century, year 1900 something. Reminiscences of a Stock Operator by Jesse Livermore. I might want to do that book as well, but I might want to do it with Beau because it's old enough that Beau will be interested in it. And some other book that I can't remember now. And he literally said to me on my first day, just go and sit outside, because it was July. He said, go and sit outside and read these books and then come back, and then we'll talk about something else. So my first day on fund management was basically reading this book, which is a good start, really, because it is a very sensible book on how to do this sort of thing. The book is broken into a series of lessons. He says that the amateur investor has substantial advantages over the professional investor. And I actually agree with that. I've done the job of running a fund. Now I kind of, well, when I'm not here, I kind of run my own money at home. And I don't feel at any great disadvantage of doing it that way. In fact, I do genuinely agree with him when we come on this, that I have lots of advantages by doing it in a personal capacity over that of a professional capacity. So we break this book down. We look at the lessons that are in it, and I'll give you my perspectives on why I think that he's basically right on that. So it'll make a nice refreshing change from the Bitcoin stuff that I did last week. The only thing I will say is that the book is a bit dated in places. So, for example, he says that don't go out and do any investing until you bought a house. Well, in the 80s, of course, you just went out and bought a house. You didn't really think anything of it. But these days, it is a fundamentally different proposition. And if you are a young person, you probably need to generate some high alpha returns on your portfolio before you can even have the money to put down a deposit, or least of all buy a house outright. So that is changed somewhat. Also, back then, and even when I was doing it, you could get outsized returns on smaller companies, which is one of the things he emphasizes. More recently, the only companies that have been able to invest in the sort of things that can generate those higher returns have actually been the larger companies. It's all become a little bit inverted. But nevertheless, there are some plenty of other timeless lessons in there. And who knows, this style of investing may come back to dominate soon. And these are all useful lessons, so we go through them anyway. The other thing I would say is that actually I'm not sure why you would do stock investing at the moment unless you had a high degree of certainty on anything that you were looking at, because of course you've got Bitcoin, where you've got a very high return profile asset over the course of the next 10 years or so. If you're investing on shorter time periods, then maybe that is unsuitable. But otherwise, I feel that this book doesn't quite have the impact that it used to have, but nevertheless, still brilliant stuff in there. Right, so let's get into his first lesson then. Why does he feel that the amateur investor has advantages over the pro? Well, the first one is the size of the funds that you're deploying. So if you're doing this professionally, you're having to invest a very large amount of money. And it basically makes it much, much harder to get in and out of positions because you're doing it at volume. And there are fewer places that you can do that. And you tend to move the price when you do it. And even the suggestion that you might be about to do a trade, if people get wind of that, or even if you're speaking to your broker and you sort of let slip, or you're less discreet than you could be about the intention of your future purchases or sales or whatever, that kind of gets fed out into the market. It moves the price against you for what you're hoping to do. So managing money at volume is a problem. But think about it like this. Let's say you've got a fund, not even a particularly massive fund, but a middling-sized fund of say, $1 billion. Well, at least you don't want any one investment to be less than about 2%. And even that's a little bit low. Because otherwise, you know, what's the point of having it in the portfolio? It's not going to move the portfolio much either way. So, you know, most funds, they end up with something like 30 to 40 stocks, 2% being, you know, the low end, 5% being the sort of upper end. So you've got $1 billion portfolio. You want to put 2% into something. Well, 2% of a billion is 20 million. You definitely can't own more than a third of a company without triggering all sorts of takeover regulations and all that kind of stuff. And realistically, you don't really want to own more than 5% of any company that you invest in, because otherwise, again, you get back to the issues of moving the price around too much. You want to be able to actually exit at some point. And if you've got too much of it, it's very difficult to do, especially since you're already in the secondary market. It's a bit easier if you're a VC, which is what I then went on to do. So look, so you got you want to put 20 million into something, and you don't want to own more than 5%. So what does that mean? It means you can't invest in any company less than $400 million worth. So you can't invest in a company which is worth less than about getting on for half a billion, which is great because you've just excluded most of the companies on the stock exchange. You still get the large caps and you still get most of the mid caps, but the small caps are just inaccessible. So for that reason, you know, the amateur investor, he has no such restrictions, and his price and his purchases or sales can be done cleanly at the market rate without any movement of the price. So, you know, that is a pretty big advantage that the amateur investor has. So that's a good one. I agree with them on that one. Another one is an argument that Peter makes in the book is how does he describe it? He says that mediocrity is the safest play. So you have to remember that fund managers still have bosses. You know, they report into the chief investment officer or whatever the structure is in the place that you work. And the old adage is, and going back to the 80s when he was operating in this, the old adage was that you'll never get in trouble for buying IBM. The example today would probably be Apple. And basically the point he's making is if you buy Apple today and you end up losing money on it, your boss will say, oh, what's up with Apple? Because it's just considered perfectly standard and normal to own Apple. If you put your money into something less conventional, which a couple of years ago might have been, say, for example, Tesla, and you lost money on it, well, then your boss would be like, well, what's wrong with you? So the first example is what's wrong with Apple, and the second example, what's wrong with you? And so because of that, people with bosses who do investing tend to gravitate towards things that they know are not going to put themselves out on a limb if it doesn't work out for them. So you get that sort of push towards the centre, the mediocrity. So I'd agree with that as well. That's also true. Third reason why amateurs have a better time of it than the pros is because fund managers spend about 25% of their time explaining what it is that they did. And I can relate to that. That's true. So you'll need to explain to your investment committee or your chief investment officer. You have to explain what you do. You have to explain what you're doing to compliance, to marketing, to investor roadshows. You know, a whole bunch of people that you need to invest in. This was most stark when I was doing VC rather than traditional fund management. But I would be going and looking for an investment. This is an unlisted investment. It's not on the stock exchange, so I had to do all of my own research. I'd have to get myself to the point where I was convinced that, yes, I want to stake my reputation on investing in this company. And then so I'd have to do all of that work. And then I'd have to get to my investment committee and basically explain all of that all over again in some considerable detail. And then you'd have to do the same thing with, you know, explaining it to your other partners, you know, key investors. You know, it would come up in your roadshows. It might be a question that you have to take through compliance and all the rest of it. So, yeah, there was an awful lot of having to stop and explain yourself, which as an amateur investor, you just get to that first point, which is when you're convinced and then you go. You don't then have to tag on an extra week or 2 weeks or whatever it is of trying to convince other people. So, yep, that is good. His fourth point, and it's a really good one, this one, is the capital is dependent on the client. So basically what he means is when the stock market is riding high and investments are expensive, everybody wants to give you money. So your fund is growing, new units in your unit trust or your exchange traded fund, whatever it is expanding. So you've got lots of capital to put to work when everything is expensive, but that's not when you need it. When the stock market is cheap and prices are falling, people are taking their money out. And so when prices are cheap, you then get capital taken away from you. And it is hellishly annoying. It is hellishly annoying because when the stock price is down, when the stock market is low, you're looking at all these bargains and you're thinking, God, I would love to invest in this stuff, but you haven't got any money, so you can't. And then likewise, when everything is sort of run up and you're thinking to yourself, oh, well, look, I don't really want to invest in anything because I think the market is a bit toppy at the moment. People keep flooding you with more money and you've got to put it somewhere. Because the average investor who invests through these funds, they just run counter-cyclical to the market the whole time. So it's a nightmare. It's a complete nightmare. And the worst thing is at that inflection point when the markets start to turn against you, and let's say there's a big day, you know, because quite often the markets run up and then there's a big correction, right? And it comes. And the market sells off quite heavily. And the day before that, things were still good. So on the day things are starting to sell off, you're still getting inflows because the inflows come from the previous day. But then on the second day, everybody panics and they start selling out of the fund. Right, and what that means is you then got to find redemption. So you've got to liquidate your portfolio in order to meet the redemptions of the people coming out of your fund. But because normally when you get into these sort of panic situations where prices start to spike down, the bid just disappears. So it's very difficult to sell your stocks. And the only stocks that you can get a good bid on are your best stocks. So because your clients are running counter-cyclically to the market, whenever this happens, you have to then sell your best stocks, which is the last thing you want to do. You want to sell your worst stocks, but you can't get a decent bid on them. So that is a right nightmare. And that is often why when the market starts to turn and it starts to have a bit of a hiccup, you get a dramatic sudden sell-off. Because what happens is the fund managers know that this behaviour is going to be manifest. So they just go to their team and say, right, take 10% off the top of everything. Just sell 10% of everything. I don't care. I'm not interested in the relative merits of this, that, or the other thing. I don't want to do a rebalancing of whatever else. It's just the news flow has turned, and I want to sell 10% of everything right now. Get on the phone, sell 10% just now, straight off the top. So yes, if you are an individual investor, you don't have any of that nonsense that I've just outlined. So that is going to give you a significant boost straight away. So the other thing that I would say is if you're an individual investor, you can invest for the long term as well. Because another thing, professional investors, a big problem they got is even though, you know, they might describe themselves as having a long-term focus, they don't. They still got a job to keep. So they are managing their portfolio with a view to actually quite short time scale. I mean, as much as daily time scale, because you've got to remember with the stock market is you get a second by second quote. So you can measure your performance second by second. And if you see things start to turn off and you're like, okay, well, I might have a bad day, but then it could become a bad week and a bad month. And how many bad months can I afford before I get the chop? So invariably, professional investors, they end up managing their risk profile to a very short-term degree, which also impacts the upside that they can get on the other side of that. So, as a personal investor now, I just don't care. I mean, I can have high volatility. I can have months and months of poor performance, and I just don't care because I'm going into a position that I'm happy with for the longer term, and I don't need to answer to anyone. So therefore, you know, I can my superpower is now basically having a different time scale, and the pros can't follow me into that. So, you know, I win. You know, I can get much better returns now as a personal investor than I could as a professional investor, just by having all of those constraints that Peter's talking about alleviated. Oh, another one is he says don't over diversify. There was this thing that, you know, this phase where people thought they need to have like 30 things in their portfolio in order to make it diversified. Peter makes the point, which I agree with very much, is don't over diversify. And Peter says if he could, he would have one stock. And again, that's something I've done. Now I'm a personal investor. If I want to have a 6 month or a year period where I've got one stock, then I'll just have one stock. I think I've got about two or three at the moment, about three. Yeah, I've got three investments, and I'm perfectly happy with that because I don't want to sell one of them to buy my fourth best idea. Because the difference between my first best idea and my fourth best idea is just too big a gap. So, I'll run with three. So these are all things that mean that, you know, don't get intimidated by there being professional investors out there, because, you know, actually you can do it yourself and you've got all of those advantages that they don't have. So that is good. Right. What else does he say? Oh, yes, there's a whole section on the book talking about exploiting your knowledge base. So, you know, even as an amateur investor, you have things that you know or that you're good at. You might be a gamer, you might be into your fashion, you might be, you know, whatever else. You could just be a consumer. But whatever, the point is, all of those things give you a window into something that give you a head start on the Wall Street analyst or the whatever the London equivalent is. We're a bit spread out in London, but you've got all of that advantage that you can see things resonating before they do. Now, personally, I still absolutely kick myself for not grabbing Netflix and Amazon. It was just stupidly obvious that Netflix and Amazon was going to be a thing, and I didn't buy in. Now, I mean, partly that was because I was working for places that pretty heavily want you to invest in the funds fund rather than just going and doing your own PA dealing. So that, but I would have had to have got sign off from compliance and the chief investment officer and all that kind of different stuff. But I should have just done that and gone out and bought Netflix and Amazon. I'd like to think that if I wasn't so encumbered, I would have done that. But you know, you see my point. It was you don't need to have any special knowledge just to see that. I mean, just from, well, maybe you didn't use them, but I'm presuming everybody here used Netflix and Amazon in the early days. It was perfectly bloody obvious that they were going to be fantastic investments, and yet most of us didn't buy them. Thumbs up to you if you did. But you know, there are other things that you will be coming through and seeing all the time that you can look at and think, okay, well, actually, no, that's the thing, whatever that thing is. And then if you the way that Peter described it is, if you like the store, you'll like the stock.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.